bizradio.co.uk/2 in association with bizradio.co.uk. With me, Paul Andrews, and the lovely Bird on a Bike. We were talking with Graham Galpin earlier on about the High Street. We've got another fantastic guest to introduce you to in the second half of the show. We've still got loads of tweets and emails coming in, so we will read a few of those. What you got, Bird?
I just want to say, Graham, I could talk about this whole... We love this conversation about politics, about how we can... My biggest thing is this, and I say this to Paul all the time, we can't, as spectators, complain or moan because we're not prepared to go into the arena and do what you did. And I really say that, don't I? I say that to you all
you
the
do.
Time.
Yeah.
You can't moan there, Mr. Andrews. I can't moan unless I'm prepared to do the work you have done.
Yeah.
And I really think that.
I did stand once, but I lost.
Yeah, you did, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
2011.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And I really love this. So, and I always think, if I was going to go in and be that person's voice, because that's what you are, aren't you? Aren't you the town's voice? Is that what you would say you are?
Well, I was elected by people in what was then Stour Ward, which is the residential side towards the motorway side of the town. And I looked after their interests in terms of specific cases, but as a member of the cabinet, mine was a strategic overview. So of course we listened to what people said to us. Yeah, we want a better town. We don't want this old one. But you can't do it as a delegate. We're not delegates. We're elected officials.
Yeah, interesting. Because I would say that's probably one of the biggest things, and I'm going to say the word Brexit, is that we've said what we wanted to happen, and I think that's everybody's biggest complaint. Just do what you have been voted to do, which was, and I think this word of voice is a big thing that we feel we've given people our voices. Go on.
No, I don't want to interrupt.
No, but it's true,
right.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I was saying to Graham before we came on air, I don't know if you've seen that they finally announced that there is going to be an election in December.
A general election,
yeah. And one of the things I said to Graham was, what has opened people's eyes, and I don't think there's any putting the genie back in the bottle now, is how tenuous our democracy is, and how it's been hijacked by different people to do different things against the will of other people. And I don't think that you'll put the genie back in the bottle now. I think so many people are going, you know, party politics doesn't mean a thing, you know, because all the parties are fragmented. They're all going off in different directions. There's no real consistency amongst any of the parties. You could vote for a party, but you wouldn't know what you were getting.
It's an interesting point, because I will put my hand up and said I voted Remain.
Right.
But as soon as we lost that cause, I said on air, I think to KMFM, the people have spoken. We've got to go with what the people said.
Exactly.
And I think that the most honourable people in the House of Commons are the people who did the same as I did.
Yeah.
And there are a number of them. And the people who are fighting a rear guard action one way or the other have done us no credit.
No,
and, and that's why I didn't want to debate that. But what I was trying to say was is when you're in position as you are, it's the same example, because you would have had the same values and beliefs. So even when you were in that position, you are doing what.
But your point is incredibly valid, and I think that's what I'm. I don't know how it's going to pan out, but I think that's what I'm seeing. You know, one of the issues, and I just said I stood in 2011 as an independent, Ashford independent. And there's no way you get elected. We've always elected people based on party politics in this country. It's all about the colour of the rosette. I canvassed the house, and I went up to the house and I said to the guy, do you know who you're going to be voting for? And he went, yep, Labour. And I went, no, you're not. And he went, don't you tell me who to vote for. And I went, no, I didn't mean it like that. He went, oh, I'm going to vote Labour. I went, no, you're not. And he went, no, I am. I went, no, you're not, because there isn't a candidate. I think what's happened now is that finally the electorate has woken up and is waking up to the fact that you're not getting what you think you're getting by voting in the way that we voted before. Yeah. And what I think will be the outcome of this is a lot more personal stuff where you vote for a person. Yeah. So that person says, these are my beliefs. This is my vision. This is what I want to do for you as an electorate. And you go, I like what you're saying. I'm going to vote for you. I don't care what your colour of your rosette is. I like what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's been a long time coming.
Well, isn't that just alignment? Isn't that what we all do? We all align with people who are aligned with my values and beliefs. And if I don't, then I actually can't connect with you. And I either won't be a friend or in a cut, you know.
But I think the interesting thing is, I don't think by the vehicle of a national political party, you can have aligned views, because what they've proved is they don't have aligned views amongst themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's what's been proven here, is that there are so many things that have shattered that illusion of party, whatever you want to call it, dogma. Yeah. You know, you had silos of, you know, the blue party, the red party and the yellow party all stood for something, and you either align with one or the other. But what they've shown is they don't even align with themselves any longer.
So it comes back to, again, that thing of how do we, are you, when you're voted in, are you, when you're elected for these things, do you do the voice of the people with a connection with vision, with a connection with leadership, with a connection of how do you deal with that environment?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the people I think about is the Duke of Wellington. Now, the Duke of Wellington led his troops through thick and thin, and they absolutely adored him because they knew where they were going, they knew what they were doing, and they knew that where possible he cared for them. But, you know, in terms of making sure they had the right boots or the right guns and so forth, you know, he didn't come and tuck them in at night. But that's how I think elected representatives ought to be. You need to provide the leadership with compassion. So you do it, you do the right thing, and it's darned uncomfortable sometimes. You know, I've made some decisions when I was in the council that I would rather not have had to have made. But you can't shy away from them. You can't be a coward. And that's
but the easy decisions are made at the bottom. That's why only the top leaders have to decide difficult decisions, isn't it?
That's exactly right.
You know, only get those decisions that challenge, and else somebody else would have made them for you.
And that's the problem, isn't it? Is that someone in a position of power or an ability to do something can see a picture that you can't see as well, you know, of all the things that you need to take into account. And sometimes, especially with national politics, they can't even tell you what that is, because there are certain things that prevent them telling you what that is.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, we have to rely on, you know, on people telling us what they're trying to tell us. And when you look back at strong leaders in history, most of them have been vilified whilst they've been in power for doing the wrong thing, even though they actually ended up doing the right thing as a nation.
Time will tell, won't it?
And the time tells when you go, blimey, that, you know, that worked. But at the time, everybody screamed their head off about it. It's a tough call.
Really interesting.
It's a tough call. You know, and
how do people get into local decision making? I'd like to call it, like you have been involved in, Graham.
Well, there are all sorts of ways. You can become a parish councillor. You can join a voluntary organisation that has some influence locally. You know,
is that what you did, Graham? So how did you get into the realm of these decisions and these arenas?
The fact is that I've been doing regeneration consultancy for about 20 years before I got coerced by somebody in the Conservative Party. Other parties are available.
not many of them in Ashford, though, to be honest.
to stand as a candidate, and I did, and I gave up my business because I was absolutely passionate about getting Ashford right. You can't be a full-time cabinet member and have a business as well. But that business was about regenerating all over the country. Everything from MG Rovers breakdown and what we did about that through to Turner Contemporary and Stanhope even at times. You know, all of those things I've done. I feel I'm stealing your time. I'm sorry about this.
No. We've got time.
Okay, right. It's, you know, so to get into politics, there is always a shortage of candidates. When we come to an election, we have to root around, and we have a good membership of the Conservative Party, but not everybody wants to play. And the quality of those players is really important. You can get people who want the job because it means they can have councillor on their CV. Yeah. I'm not going to criticise them for this. Yes, I am.
Yeah.
But if you're really passionate, that will carry you to the top.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting.
I'm a great believer in localism, and I think things happen at the bottom up. They don't happen from the top down. And if you want anything changed, if you want anything done, you do it from the bottom up. And I don't think local stuff gets enough kudos. One of the things personally I would like is to abandon party politics at a local level. I don't think it helps. I really don't think it helps to have people stand in as a Conservative or a Labour or a Liberal candidate. I think at local politics, you should have people standing on a platform of what they want to do and what they believe and what they see.
Like back in the World West. When they used to stand, this is what I believe.
Well, one of the problems is, and I found this standing as an independent candidate, people don't actually think about it. They just vote colours.
They do.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not helpful. It's not helpful. And Graham's absolutely right. There's always a lack of good quality candidates. My story that I told earlier, that, you know, about the Red Party not having a candidate because nobody stood. So that person was disenfranchised. He wanted to vote for a Red candidate that wasn't available. You know, for me, I just don't see the point of party politics at a local level. I just don't see it. I really don't. And I have to be perfectly honest. I know someone, not in this council, but in another council, that stood as a Conservative councillor and got elected, and they'd never voted Tory in their life. But it was the only way they could get elected.
That's true. But I think that the point you made earlier is that you align yourself with people who are like-minded.
Yeah.
And that is a vital thing to do, is because if you're a lone voice, you're far better being a choir than a lone voice. You get more noise.
Yeah.
So I do disagree with you on that one. We've almost agreed on everything else.
We've got to disagree
on
something.
That isn't bad, is it?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's not bad.
It's pretty good. Right, we need to move on because we're going to talk to Joanne in a minute. And we've got loads of tweets and loads of emails coming in. I've had a tweet from Bennett and Friends, who are makers of luxury canapes. And they say, hello, Twitter. It's another Charity Tuesday. And a little reminder that we offer some great discounts for charity social events and for social enterprises and arts organisations. If you want to find out about their offer, it's bennettandfriends.co.uk.
Excellent. Will you be joining us in December for our Women in Business Christmas Luncheon at the beautiful Eastwell Manor? It's on Tuesday, the December, I still can't believe I'm saying this, December the 3rd at 11:15 until 2:30. You need to go to www.kentwomeninbusiness.co.uk.
Fantastic. Venom Tech have been on. I said it's another great cake day in the Venom Tech office. This one is to celebrate 1 year since the launch of our Venom Chili Sauce, Steve's
Sauce.
You
love it, don't you?
I do. It is nice. It is really good. Check it out. Steve_sauce is the Twitter handle for that. Can you believe it? It's been a whole year since we were shouting about Vanilla Web and then launched outside our offices in Discovery Park. That was me shouting about their sauce.
Nice.
A year ago when they launched it. Check them out, Venom Tech or Steve_sauce.
Kent Business School invites you to our Equality, Diversity and Inclusivity Business Series event, Skills to Success, at the Dockyard Church, Chatham Historic Dockyard, on Thursday, the 31st of October, and that's from 5 till 7 in the evening. You can go and book your free ticket at www.
Web.
kentbusinessradio.co.uk/KBS.
Terry Botfield has been on. The next Marsh Networking Over Coffee is at 10 a.m. on Wednesday the 6th of November in New Romney. You can book, but they've shortened the link, but I happen to know where the link is. It's marshnetwork.co.uk. And you can hear Richard Smith from iMasters talk about his travels in search of optical excellence. So join us in a relaxed professional networking atmosphere at the Marsh Business Networking.
Well, they've got a Marsh Networking Over Coffee as well on the 6th of November, 10 till 12.
Yep, that's it.
Is that the same one?
That's it.
Is that the same one?
Yeah, yeah. What's the link? Read the link.
www.marshnetwork.co.uk.
Fantastic. There you go.
Wow, what a team.
Visit Canterbury prepares to promote the city internationally for 2020. 2020 is set to be a significant year for tourism in Canterbury, as several events in the city will put Kent on the map for international attraction. We were talking about this earlier. These are some of the events happening next year. There's the Becket 2020, marking 850 years since Thomas Becket was murdered in Canterbury Cathedral. Have they caught them yet? Medieval event are planned with a focus on pilgrimages and highlighting Canterbury's UNESCO World Heritage status.
I wonder if they dress up.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Mm.
Some guys I knew in the King's Mile had an art gallery in the Undercroft, which is where the three geezers that did the deed assembled before they went and stabbed him.
Yeah.
You can't say that.
What?
Geezers.
Well, three geezers. Yeah, they were geezers. They were.
What are you two on?
They were right geezers. They were.
My
they
day.
Were stabby geezers.
They're stabby in the back, then.
Stabby geezers, yeah, when you're not looking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who will rid me of this cardinal? Yeah. Right. Anyway, the Lambeth Conference, which is in Canterbury from July to August, is a gathering of all the active bishops with the Archbishop of Canterbury, and it happens once every 10 years, and it's happening next year. It's also the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower, one of the first pilgrim voyages to America that was organised by Robert Cushman, who came from Canterbury.
Who knew?
Yeah. It's the 75th anniversary of the UNESCO World Heritage Site of the collective Canterbury Cathedral, St. Augustine's Abbey and St. Martin's Church. It's the Folkestone Triennial, one of the UK's most ambitious public arts projects, which they expect to attract 135,000 visitors. And it's also the 149th British Open Golf at Sandwich at Royal St. George's, a global sporting event, and the 60% of the tickets are already sold.
It's great, isn't it, to hear all of that?
And it's the Dreamlands 100th, the Margaret theme park turns 100 next year.
I didn't send him a card.
No, nor did I. Oh. Yeah. It's the 150th anniversary of Kent County Cricket Club, and it's also the 150 years since Charles Dickens died, and Charles has obviously strong connections with Rochester, Canterbury and Broadstairs. If you want to join Visit Canterbury as a member, you need to contact Catherine Herndon, and you can get hold of her at Catherine, that's Catherine with a Y, dot Herndon, H-E-A-R-N-D-E-N, at canterbury.gov.uk.
I've got Shane...
Lovely bunch of coconuts?
No.
All right.
I've got Shane Record on tomorrow, who's one of our local artists in Folkestone.
Are you?
That's on my show.
Have you got a show tomorrow?
2:25.
Have you?
Yeah. The conversation 1 till 2 tomorrow with Shane Record. He's amazing. He's got his own gallery in the Creative Quarter in Folkestone. So you've just reminded me then when you were talking about artists.
I just reminded you about your show tomorrow.
Yep.
At 1 o'clock.
Yep.
Here on channelradio.co.uk/2.
Correct.
The conversation.
We're global.
With Bird.
Yep. You're and global. Shane Record.
And Shane.
I'm hoping he'll bring me in a big...
A freebie.
He won't. He did the TEDx talk. He did a live painting on Folkestone TEDx. Really interesting. You're going to see what he does. He's crazy. I love him.
Fantastic.
I've got a very funny personal story about Shane Record. I don't think he'd be too happy, I'll tell you, but it's very funny.
You can tell me later.
I will. You'll go, just typical you. Anyway, Stand Out and Scale Up. Grow Conference Ashford. This wouldn't life be easier if you could generate predictable, reliable income in less time with less stress. I don't believe it. Are you always learning, always improving person? One of the best ways is attending a conference because you know that you are going to meet businesses just like you. Businesses that know how important it is to break out of the old ways of thinking. We were only talking about this earlier, weren't we, off air? Mm. Who wants to meet other business leaders who, like you, would love to get results, businesses like you to network and collaborate with. So the expertise and knowledge are of 5 speakers, and they give their inspiration to take action. There's the missing link to everybody. Wednesday, the 20th of November, 8:30 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon. And this is at Ashford International Hotel. It's only £47 plus VAT, and that includes refreshments and a conference guide. Go to www.growkent.co.uk.
Fantastic. Do you know what? We're going to talk to our next guest. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome Joanne Taylor from Fit for Trade. Joanne, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. We really do appreciate
it. Why don't you kick off by telling a little bit about yourself and what you do, and then we'll talk about Fit for Trade and the fenestration
industry. Well, I don't know if I can follow Graham, to be fair, but we'll have a go. We're trying to make fenestration a bit sexy for all you listeners.
I think you have already by saying fenestration. I think it's great.
Yeah, you've got to be careful with that one.
Yeah, because a lot of people think it's a little thing that you stick in your hat, don't you?
You have to certainly be careful when you're typing an email, because it does come out on that predictive text as the other word, so you have to be very careful. So anyway, so for those people that don't know what fenestration is, it's it actually derives from the Latin word as
and French.
In window.
Fenestra in French is window.
Fenestra.
Yeah.
So basically it means window or opening. But what we get involved in, Fit for Trade, we are a private independent training provider. I'm one of the directors of the company and co-founders. And we get involved in all things weird and wonderful to do with fenestration. Now, when we talk about windows, it's not just windows. It is manufacturing, so the manufacturing of the frame and the glass that actually goes into your domestic property at home, whether that be windows, doors, conservatories, or obviously the high-end scope things like the shard and the gherkin, the commercial end of the property as well that we get involved in. So there's sort of two arms to it. There's the domestic side and there's the commercial build side. So
absolutely. It's an interesting industry, isn't it? Because the double glazing industry had perception issues a while back. And, of course, a lot of that is not called for and not fair.
And untrue.
And yeah, exactly. But that means that you kind of battle in terms of putting a perception across of getting people into the industry, of fighting those perceptions.
I think what a lot of it is that when you're talking about the industry, you have to mention the domestic side of it, because that is
what people relate
to. That's what they relate to. That's what they know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you can obviously start talking to somebody about the windows and doors in their own home, that's the icebreaker. And to be quite honest, when I started back in the 80s in the construction sector, it was a completely different kettle of fish.
But so many other industries were too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. When you started, Joanne, did you actually start in, were you working in the business?
I started my glorious career, basically the dreaded careers officer asked me, you know, what I wanted to do, and the options that I was given at the time, like most girls in at that sort of time, was retail, hairdressing, receptionist or nurse. And I said, well, I don't really want to do any of those. I want to do something a bit arty.
Right.
And basically they said, oh, well, there's a position here, nobody else wants it, and it's in an architectural practice. I didn't even know what architecture was. And I went, yeah, sign me up. Let's have a go at that. And 16 years of age, and that was my introduction to the construction sector. And, and I just got pulled into it, really.
So you were working for an architectural
I was working for an architectural practice, in Herne Bay, funny enough.
Right, okay. And what was the roles that you were undertaking? What were you doing? Were you designing buildings?
I used to go out and do building surveys,
right,
and a lot of quantity surveying sort of stuff. But then they, my wonderful boss, and I would say he was my mentor from a very early age, picked up on the things that I really wasn't very good at, i.e. the math side. So he basically said, you're never going to make an architect all the time you're here. I can't make you an architect because you just haven't got it. And you're
going to design wonky buildings.
It wasn't that. It's just that I didn't realise at the time I had a condition called dyscalculia. so I can't see numbers.
Right, okay.
Which is obviously not so good if you're an architect,
mm-hmm.
And you're talking about loads and that sort of stuff. It's not so good. So basically, he capitalised on what I was good at, and obviously after being in the business for sort of like 6 years, was actually running the technical drawing office.
Right, okay.
And that's how I got into the construction industry, spent more and more time on site, then went on to be a site manager.
Right.
And how I got into the window industry is basically through my site management and the training side, health and safety side of things. No one would actually train the window industry guys because no one felt that they could actually get on with them. They wouldn't listen to them. And it wasn't a particularly overly regulated industry.
Mm.
So they were, you know, the rogues, I suppose.
Right.
And I went in and got on like a house on fire and said, this is a little bit different. And to be quite honest, it is one of the powerhouses or the unknown powerhouses of the construction sector.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's interesting in the story that you told there is that it shows you how by imposing some discipline and qualifications on an industry, it can bring an industry up to spec, if you like, yeah? Because you're quite right. Many years ago, it did have an unenviable reputation. But by imposing that discipline, imposing qualifications, imposing training on it, you bring that around, you turn it around.
There is a perception, anyway, of a lot of industries. Oh, yeah, but because it was so heavily publicised, the parents and the teachers that I'm engaged with now are the people that heard it firsthand, and they're not actually speaking to their youngsters and actually encouraging them to go into the industry because of their own perceptions. And obviously we are led by media and our parents.
Mm.
And that's the battle that we're now facing to obviously overcome that, to say, well, you know, there is a wealth of opportunity in our sector.
Mm.
And the, you know, the salary, and let's be honest, most youngsters, that's how you're going to get them.
Yeah, sure.
Is the fact that, well, you know, you're earning more than electricians, plumbers, other tradesmen. And to be quite honest, in schools, that's where they tend to get pushed into the traditional construction trades.
And it's an important industry. You know, we need windows and doors and conservatories. You know, it's one of the things.
And we talk about technology. You know, in 30 years, it's come on so much. You know, we've got a lot of thermal, you know,
I was just going to say, you know, a lot of young people, Generation Z, are very concerned about the environment and stuff like that. And the fenestration industry is a leader in those kind of things, you know, in insulation, you know.
The recycling, I mean, people think plastic, you're not recycling, but everything is recycled within our industry.
Mm. You know, but we've come a long way as well in terms of heating our homes, where we would expend a lot of money. I drove past somewhere the other day when I had a sign up that said coal for sale, and I thought, blimey, who's going to buy that? You know, when was the last time you saw anyone with a coal fire? Yeah, I can't remember. So of course we've come a long way in the last few years with things like this, and things like double glazing or triple glazing, or we're probably onto quadruple glazing by now, aren't we? I don't know where we are with it at the moment.
Still triple glazing, but there's so many different product choice now for consumers.
Yeah,
you know, we're talking about colour. We're a lot of people going back to wood, obviously conservation.
Yeah.
Aluminium's coming back. That's very, very fashionable at the moment.
Right. Okay.
So you know, there's a lot there.
Yeah, great.
Can I ask a question? I live in a listed house that's got sash windows, and those blighters at Ashford Council are very, very, because it's listed, are very difficult about replacing the windows, and we still have single glazing. Is there a way around that, do you know?
It depends on the listing that you've got. But there's
only glazed two.
There's absolutely nothing to stop you putting anything up, you know, more than single glazing in. But I had exactly the same question with Sian Murphy, actually, because she had Crittle, and Crittle's making a big comeback. So we do a lot of replacement sash windows, which are double glazed.
Yeah.
On listed buildings.
Yeah. I mean, is just a general purpose question, and this obviously will depend on the state of anything. I mean, is there a way where you could retain the original frames and just change the glass that's in it? Yeah. Does that work, or is it not something that really works?
It's not something that I would say if you're going to change it for the cost change of the glass, it. You might as well just change the whole lot.
Yeah. It's interesting when you talk about making window frames. My eldest son lives in France, and he's rebuilding a hovel that he lives in at the moment. And I was talking to him the other day, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm putting windows into the new bathroom." And I went, "Oh, and who's doing that?" And he went, "I am." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Do you want to see a picture of the frames I've made?" And I said, "Yeah, but why are you doing this?" He said, "Well, nobody round here in France makes double glazing." He said, "You've got to do it yourself." And he bought himself a turning machine, and he made his wooden frames, and very artistically done. So I was quite surprised. And a lot of his friends were going, "Oh, how'd you do that? And how'd you do that?" So I think there is a perception that's starting to change about people that want to look at things like that. They want to look at doing things. And allied to the concept of it being eco-friendly as well. Do you get involved in things like solar panels?
Funnily enough, we do. There is a qualification in it that we do. There's another one as well called GRP, which... if you think about a lot of the car parks and the staircases, which was predominantly steel manufactured,
yep.
Well, it looks like plastic now. Mm. It's usually bright colours, and it looks like plastic, but it's actually a glass product.
Right, okay.
It's actually made from glass.
Okay.
And that's where all the recycling comes in. And funny enough, I've got quite a few solar panel, because you have to have, obviously, your ticket for new build.
Right.
A lot of our qualifications are driven by the CSCS card scheme.
Yep, yep.
Our industry, it took a little bit of time. We've still got people that are saying, "I've been in the industry 20, 30 years. Why do I need this card?"
Yep.
Well, grandfather rights have been gone for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And I must admit, I heavily endorse the fact that CSCS has actually helped raise the standard of our industry.
Absolutely.
Because... Yeah. What people don't realise is that if you are fitting a window or taking something out and you are replacing it, there is a heavy amount of building regulations that you have to know.
Yeah.
And you are the responsible person.
Mm.
You cannot blame the surveyor. Mm. You cannot blame the manufacturer. You are responsible for as an installer for what you put
took it
into
out and
that
you put
house.
It in. Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
We have seen some horrendous things, you know, obviously in London where... You've seen panes falling out and all that sort of stuff. It does happen.
Yeah.
But you've got to be aware of what those building regulations state.
Yep.
And that is part a big part of our industry.
Yep.
Is that just because you've been doing it 30 years doesn't mean that you're up to date with what you need to know.
Well, it's like any industry. It's like electricians or plumbers or gas safe, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The technology changes all the time. You know, if you're an electrician, what are we on now? 17th edition? I can't remember. Yeah. You have to have your qualifications regularly updated to keep pace with technology.
Yeah.
And the changing landscape of what we're doing and what's allowed to do. Yeah.
And again, that's another thing about changing the perceptions, because we have got an ageing workforce. A third of our installers probably in the industry are over the age of 50.
Wow, okay.
So there we do have a huge skills shortage.
Mm.
But part of what I do is keeping people in the industry. And that's one of the campaigns that I'm running.
Through retraining?
Through not necessarily retraining. I want to keep those transferable skills still in the industry,
right, okay.
Rather than losing them to another construction sector.
Right, okay.
So because we have a skills shortage, and a lot of small to medium-sized enterprises don't actually look at the people that they've already got, and they don't recognise the talent that they've already got.
Right, okay.
To say, we can use this person and diversify that skill set into management.
Right.
Or into product design.
Mm.
Because there's a lot, obviously, that goes on, marketing, sales.
Yep.
There's so much to our industry that... It's not just about, everybody thinks about the trade aspect of it, but there's not. There's so much more. But we want to keep those people and that skill set within the industry and obviously upskill so that they can transfer that into running the business.
Yeah, absolutely. So can I ask you about the range of things that Fit for Trade do? You provide qualifications, or you help people gain qualifications in things like fitting windows and doors. Now, is it predominantly people that are already working in the industry, or are you bringing people into the industry? So do you do apprenticeships? How does it work?
There's two parts. Yeah. I am a voluntary Careers Enterprise Advisor for the Careers Enterprise Trust.
Right.
So a lot of my time is spent voluntary going out to schools, working with schools to educate and encourage more broader life skills and work skills to introduce people into our industry because they've just not heard of us from a construction trade perspective. Obviously, that does cost money and we can only do a certain amount for free.
Yep.
The problem with a lot of schools is they don't have that funding.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I want to reach out to, or certainly to your listeners, is if people know out there that there is that funding stream that these schools can tap into, our industry can only support so much towards the product. But it's an expensive, practical trade to teach into schools.
Right.
And although that we can, we do the level one qualifications that these youngsters can come out with, we do couple theory with practice. We have to have that practical element, and obviously we can't do that for free.
Right.
Absolutely. We do rely on a lot of the, our industry contacts to obviously help us with that. Mm. But obviously it's not a never-ending pot.
Yeah,
so if anyone's out there that they know where, obviously these schools can tap into extra funding streams.
Yeah.
And it is all about employability skills.
Yeah.
We're teaching them the wider aspects of functional skills, English and maths, and how they can actually get a job. Even if they don't get a job in a trade, at least they've got that transferable skill.
It's incredibly important. You've mentioned it a few times, and I totally endorse this. We do have massive skill shortages, especially in construction. There's a lot of talk about home ownership and house building and how we need to build vastly more houses. We can't build them if we haven't got the people to build them. And one of the things I've had construction companies on, and a lot of people go, you're land banking. And most of the construction companies go, do you know what? We're not. We've got the land. The reason we're not building is we haven't got anyone to build them. Yeah.
There is. I mean, we call it silly season in the industry. There are obviously peaks and troughs. Mm. There's not really a slowdown in our industry, to be fair.
Yeah.
And because obviously you have got the domestic and the commercial aspects of it. So there's never really a downtime.
Yeah.
So, of course, something's going to back up. And one of the things that I hate is when you see on grand designs, they never actually get any of their windows or glass in from the country, and it is manufactured here.
Yeah.
They always go further afield in Europe or America or Canada, and it's, well, why are you going there when it's we can manufacture it here?
Yeah.
But it's programs like that is not helping us.
Do you know, funnily enough, as Graham said earlier, I live in Tenterton, which is a small town just outside Ashford. And in the road next to me is a window manufacturer. And it's really unusual because, as you say, a lot of people don't kind of think about that. They think about, other places that they bring things to. So anyone out there that knows about sources of funding to help...
For
secondary education and getting young people to experience firsthand working in this part of the construction industry, we want to hear from you.
Definitely.
Yeah, let us know. As you know, we do... I work with the Federation of Small Business. We do a lot of work in schools as well, which, again, we have to do for free because there's no funding. It's important, and funnily enough, a couple of weeks ago we had Ella Brocklebank and Cheryl Coolsbrook. Who are very heavily, both of them work in construction, but they run Kent Women in Construction and also the Kent Construction Forum with the Chamber of Commerce, talking about construction in general and getting more young people in general and more women into construction.
Well, we can go out into schools and we can educate and we can broaden people's horizons as to what is available in our industry sector. But there's nothing more important than getting hands on.
You've got to experience it
in a safe environment.
Yeah, because it's that kind of business, isn't it? It is a
It's a visual thing.
It's a trade business, yeah. But it's about doing things physically, making things, repairing things, making things work. And those people that suit that kind of industry will never find out unless they try it.
No, that's right.
Yeah. And, you know, all the theory in the world is of no use until you've gone, do you know what? Is this going to fit? Mm. Does it work? Can I make a hole to put that in? That's the bit that's important, isn't it?
And so there's lots of bits of the industry that obviously are dying out. Yeah. I mean, glass blowing is quite a big part.
Right.
Obviously, because we're industry based, we tend to get involved not in the decorative side. It's in the scientific glass blowing.
Right.
And these little places you wouldn't even know are available in Kent. Right. It still happens. It's all still hand blown.
Right.
And it's dying out. Once that person retires, that's it. There's no more.
Right.
You know, you're not going to, you can't buy that in.
Yeah, sure. Still. No, absolutely.
So that's why we're obviously trying to, you know, get other people in the industry and the people that we've already got to retrain to pass on that knowledge. Mm. Otherwise, once it's gone, it's gone.
Mm.
And that would be a dying shame, especially in the art of glass blowing.
I've still got a tick about this all these years later. When I was at school, which was a long, 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 long time ago, we actually did glass blowing, yeah? And I've still got this vivid memory of the teacher blowing some glass in a tube, and there was a big bubble, a red-hot glass, and one of the kids went and grabbed it.
And grabbed it, yeah.
And, of course, the whole thing exploded, burnt his hands to bits, and there was bits of glass flew everywhere. And I've still got a picture of that in my mind.
Well, I've got an interesting fact for you.
Yeah.
The saying, shut your gob, actually derives from molten, shut your gob, because when you were actually glass blowing, you had to make sure that you shut your gob, otherwise you got a mouthful of molten.
Ah.
And that's where it like comes it. From. So like it. The saying, shut your gob, actually derives from glass blowing.
Blowback.
No, don't that's something hiccups, else.
Yeah, okay.
You don't want hiccups, do you?
No, exactly. Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, again, when you talk about your industry, you don't think of things like glass blowing.
No.
Yeah. And the whole range of different things, because it's not just about glass as well. You're talking about frames, and you were mentioning the comeback of aluminium and wooden frames. On the commercial, just talking for the last few minutes about the commercial side of it, you mentioned the shard and the gherkin and stuff like that. You do see more and more buildings that are almost entirely glass.
There's nowhere in London that you don't go that the, you know, we're not talking about your traditional brick buildings anymore.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it is steel and glass.
Yeah. Is there a rationale for why that is? I mean, presumably it's easier or better to build in steel and glass than it is to build a dirty, great 93-storey brick building.
I think that it's certainly more pleasing to the eye.
Mm.
Obviously, there are certain parts of London where you go, especially when it's very, very hot, they have a real problem, and they've had to look at that. The Mayor of London had to look at that even when Boris was in, that you couldn't actually drive down certain streets because the amount of glass.
Mm.
So obviously that had to be replaced, and they had to look at that because it was just too hot and everything was melting.
Magnified it, yeah, absolutely.
So, it's a product that is changing all the time. Mm. I mean, how far we can go with it is another matter.
But presumably it makes a building more flexible, because one of the things with building tall buildings is they have to be flexible.
Yes.
My youngest son has just come back from Japan, and he was there when the hurricane hit and the volcano went off and the earthquake happened in Tokyo. And it only took them 24 hours to clean up afterwards, because they're so used to building buildings that either survive or just fall down and you clear them away and they build another one. So presumably flexible materials in big buildings are a big thing.
Certainly, I think, you know, in London, what people don't realise as well is a lot of these, you can't have bomb-proof.
Mm.
But obviously there was a lot of, obviously, terror scares in London, that's a lot of the glass was changing, because obviously if you've got buildings like that being blown up, exactly. It's a deadly material anyway, just to handle it, let alone, you know, it blowing out.
Yeah.
So obviously they call it bomb proof, but obviously it's not.
Yeah.
But it's
the way it breaks.
Yeah, it's to protect. And that's like the, you know, the glass in your windscreen in the car.
I was just going to say,
I think exactly we all remember. I remember driving my Morris Marina when I first passed my test, my 1.3 coupe, and driving along, and my windscreen just went.
Yeah,
and I was absolutely covered in glass. That just would not happen now.
All the little cubes, and you don't. You have shatterproof windscreens.
Exactly.
Yeah, and also, I don't know if you've come across this in your industry. A lot of nanotechnology, which is what they coat glass with, doesn't even get wet. Yeah, you don't even need wipers anymore because the rain just bounces off the windscreen. Mm. Interesting stuff. Joanne, we could talk about this forever. Sadly, we're kind of running towards the end of the show. If people want to find out more about Fit for Trade and the stuff you're doing, what's the best way of getting a hold of you? And also, remember those people out there with access to working with people like Joanne on funding young people coming into the industry. We want to hear from you.
Excellent. Best way to get hold of us is Twitter at Fit for Trade, or our email address, office@fitfortrade.co.uk, or go onto our website, www.fitfortrade.co.uk.
Cool.
And all our online and blended learning provisions on there as well. So if you are looking to upskill, or we've got Business Suite on there, we've got leadership skills, we've got health and social care on there as well. So although it's aimed predominantly at construction sector, if you're looking and you've got disability issues and can't get out but still want to train, we've actually got those in place to actually help you.
Fantastic. Joanne, thank you so much for that. There is a link to the website on the Kent Business Radio website. That will stay there forever, so do have a look at that if you didn't get to write that down. And you can find Fit for Trade website via that link on the Business Bunker website. For the moment, Joanne Taylor at Fit for Trade, thank you so much.
Lovely, thank you.
Cool. I've had a tweet from Michael Park Surveyors, and they said, hello, Vanilla Webb, we'd love a Business Bunker shout-out, please, while you're talking about all these property things. So there's a Business Bunker shout-out for Michael Park Surveyors, MPSL, on the Twitter.
Nice. We've had loads of tweets. They've just rolled in. But one thing I did want to ask, Joanne, apprenticeships. Do you get loads of them coming through you? Are you watching it grow now?
It is growing, unfortunately, with the levy and non-levy. 95% of our client base is small to medium-sized enterprise. And guess what? You can't get funding for them.
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yeah.
So although it has kicked off in a big way, and we have changed a lot of perspectives for people coming into the industry and our client base taking them on, it's incredibly difficult to get funding.
Yeah.
So it is a shame.
It's crazy, right?
The government keep messing with apprenticeships. Exactly. Need to stop, because they've made a complete mess of this. The levy has just confused everybody.
Yes.
We've made lots of inroads in talking in schools. We've made lots of inroads into people wanting to do apprenticeships. Once the levy kicked in, everybody went, give up, don't understand.
In our industry, it only makes up about 5% of businesses, and you're only talking about the big guys.
Yeah.
Nobody else. So it's just a shame.
Cool. We're very, very close to the end of the show. Have you got anything else you need to read out?
No.
I need to tell you about this, which is another interesting thing that's happening. I'm hosting a charity comedy night at the Ditton Community Centre on Sunday the 1st of December, headlined by Simon Brodkin, known to you, me and everybody else as Lee Nelson. Yeah? How they've got Lee Nelson at the Ditton Community Centre?
And you're doing it? And you're emceeing it?
No.
I thought you said you are then.
No.
I was excited.
Supporting Simon will be Canterbury's own Mark Simmons, who himself is a rising star on the comedy circuit, and he's about to start appearing on Mock the Week. So if you could give us a shout-out on the Business Bunker show, please, we would really appreciate it. The tickets are £12.50 and can be purchased through Brodkin and Ward Tickets 2019 at yahoo.com. Doors open at 7:30, but I advise people to arrive promptly to ensure they are seated before the act begins at 8 p.m. And the whole event is in aid of Aspire, who are being represented by Ben at next year's London Marathon. And Aspire support people with spinal cord injuries. So it's all in aid of the Aspire charity. And that's taking place at Ditton Parish Council, Ditton Parish Hall, on December the 1st. Get along to it.
Yes.
Have you got anything that you need to do before we go?
No.
Okay. I need to tell you about the Business Bunker Extra Show this Friday. Amanda is joined by Ben Abbott, and their guest is Chris Wilmot, and Chris is from Pentascape. So that's 11 o'clock on Friday, this Friday for the Business Bunker Extra Show. But that's it for another week. Thank you so much. I want to say a huge thank you to Graham Galpin and Joanne Taylor for being our guests today, and to my co-host, the lovely Bird on a Bike. We'll be back next Tuesday with another Business Bunker Show. Have a great week, everyone.
This is Channel 2.
The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.